The single most important aspect of AA recovery, however, is the principle of one alcoholic relating to another alcoholic. Therefore, only alcoholics actually participate in our meetings. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful to you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and or understanding. Good evening. My name is Daryl Wiggum, and I am an alcoholic. Welcome to the Pacific Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers, a coffee break, and a main speaker. Our first 10-minute speaker is Hero S.
Thank you, Daryl. My name is Hiro Sasaki, and I am an alcoholic. I'm grateful to be here, grateful to be sober, and wow, look at all these alcoholics in the room. This is great. November 12, 2007, a power greater than me that I didn't believe in, had no time for, had a resentment against, was terrified of, that I was running away from, separated me from King Alcohol, and I'm really grateful for that. I've got a home group, it's a Bellflower Big Book group, and I've got a sponsor, his name is Bob D. And I should probably pray up right now, because when I took the 11th step this morning, I realized that I get to pause when I'm agitated or in doubt, and get to ask God for the right thought or action, the right actions, obviously to breathe, otherwise I'll keep talking and talking without breathing, and I'll pass out in front of you, so... And the right thought is, God, grant me the power to carry the message you'd have me carry. I'm supposed to let you know in a general way what I used to be like, what happened, and what I'm like today. And I was made in Japan. we moved to primarily white neighborhoods, felt different. That kind of culminated in moving to a mixed neighborhood, but it was Tuscaloosa, Alabama at the turn of the 70s. And that was at a point when I had finally learned how to speak English without a Japanese accent, and suddenly I speak English wrong, because in Tuscaloosese, hi has 3 syllables. You're like, hi. And then we moved to California. And then if you're an Asian like me and you grew up around non-Asians, and then you're suddenly around other Asians, they have a name for an Asian like me, like banana or Twinkie, yellow on the outside, white on the inside. And turns out I don't fit in anywhere, and I'm really, really good at feeling bad. I've got one great skill, really, really good at feeling bad since I was very small. And what that looks like is my head just follows me around, and it's just like, Hiro, you suck more than anyone's ever sucked before. And then occasionally I'll glance up from my solipsism and I'll notice you doing something I disagree with, and because I'm Americanized, I'll tell you how I disapprove and what you're like, and because I'm a coward, if you're frightening, I'll run away. And then my Japanese-ness will kick in when I get home, and I'll be like, oh my God, I can't believe I did that. I really do suck more than anyone's ever sucked before, because I'm so ashamed. And I discovered my answer to this loud head and this feeling of discomfort and dis-ease and disconnection from you with alcohol at age 12. It just fixed it. It just fixed it. And at age 12 in junior high, they don't really serve you in bars. But just the idea, like if I know that I'm going to get snuck into a friend's big brother's keg party during the weekend, just knowing I'm going to have one of those little red plastic cups can get me through the week and give me a sense of ease and comfort right in the middle of the week. And it took me 30 years to get into Alcoholics Anonymous. And it took me that long because for the entire time, despite all of the evidence to the contrary that many other people would be able to see, and they'd be able to, like at age 14, 15, people were saying, hey, you might need this place called Alcoholics Anonymous. And I did what most of us did, which is to find others who can drink more than me so I could feel okay about my drinking. And I thought all the things that went wrong with my life were because of things like depression, like that suicide attempt at 16, or the difficulty getting through school, or just flaming out the last minute at something. And the reason it took so long for me to realize I was an alcoholic is that I'm a periodic, and I didn't realize that until I came in here that if you're a periodic, it's not. The question isn't, does everything turn bad with every single drink? The question for me was, can you control when I lose control? And that's what my sponsor asked me, and I can't. I can't. And that other question in the big book that asks, you know, can I stop entirely? And I'm talking to my sponsor when I first came in. I'm like, of course I can stop entirely. And he says, no. Entirely means forever, kid. And I'm like, oh, no, I've never done that before. And also, I never came in here, didn't think I was an alcoholic because I'm a periodic until I need it every day. I'm a binge drinker until I need to have it in the morning to get right. I never had a DUI yet, never been hospitalized yet, never lost a job because of alcohol yet. And even though in my fifth step, I discovered that I lost many because of alcoholism. And also because I was always able to stop. Never glad about that, but always able to until I finally wasn't. And I'm so grateful that the person I reached out for help when everything came crashing down, all the things that go wrong in my life because of my alcoholism, because of active alcoholism, are happening for me. I'm actively suicidal again. I'm psychotic again. I'm seeing things that you don't see and hearing things that you don't hear. And I'm really trying hard not to do those things and trying hard not to be psychotic. Of course, if you've ever been psychotic, you know, doesn't work so well. And I call up a dear friend. And she tells me, I'm still not an alcoholic. I'm calling her and I'm going, you know, I think I need a new shrink. I don't trust my shrink. I need some lithium. I think I'm bipolar. And she asked me what's going on. And I tell her, it was probably the first of a series of surrenders. And I tell her everything, all the skeezy acting out I'm doing, all the filthy behavior, all the crap I'm pouring into my body just to feel okay with my life. And after I burn for 20, 25 minutes, she says, Hiro, I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been sober for 22 years. Maybe you need a meeting. And this really profound thing happens to me that I now describe as physiological. Like there's a branch 2 inches below my belly button that just goes pop. And I just start sobbing. Like doing stomach crunches. Like hyukka, hyukka, hyukka. Like snot pouring out the nose. Like full body release kind of crying. And I'm sobbing like this because I don't know what just happened. She's the one who taught me 6 years earlier how to send you to AA. She's the one who taught me to tell you things like, hey, you might not drink right. You might need this place called Alcoholics Anonymous. I can't help you with that. They know how to stay sober over there. She taught me to tell you, hey, if you don't identify as an alcoholic, that's okay. She told me to give you one of these meeting directories like they have over here and go to one of these meetings that's an open meeting because anyone can go to one of those. And she told me to tell you, hey, if you hear about God and you don't believe in God, don't worry about that. That's advanced AA. That's a later step. And she told me to tell you, if you go to a meeting, try to identify and not compare. Try to listen for similarities and not differences. And so I was sobbing because I knew that there was an answer here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm so, so grateful that when I came in here the next day, I knew what to do. I knew what to do. I knew to listen for someone who drank a little bit like I did, but really mostly felt like I did as a result of drinking, both the good stuff and the horrific stuff. And also who said these really inexplicable things. He said, as a result of taking these steps, as a result of having a home group, as a result of being sponsorable today, as a result of having commitments, as a result of showing up even when I don't want to, I have a life where I'm happy, joyous, and free most days. And I wanted that. And today it's important for me to let you know that I have that. I have that today. And the weird thing is that I describe myself as an agnostic. I have no idea what happened before I was born. I have no idea what happens after I die. I have no idea whether God exists or not. But what I knew was that I was surrounded by all of you, people who drank like me or felt like me, but at the very best showed me that this thing could work for me too. And this thing would happen in meetings, and I hope it's happening for you in this meeting or it happened for you sometime during this meeting. What I learned later was identification, where I would hear people speak from the podium, and I would see myself in you. And I started laughing in my first week of sobriety because I was just I had a sponsor, I had a home group, I had commitments, and I started laughing, not the maniacal, scary kind of laughter that I was very familiar with, but this was a true releasing, joyful laughter. And I'm having this experience where it's like that time when in Tuscaloosa. When my mom would take me to the store and the handy dandy store, and I'm looking for the two mirrors that are facing each other. I'm going, oh, look, it's me, 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 it's me. And I remember at the tail end of my first week being at a meeting at my home group, and it felt like there was this huge energy in the room, just wah, 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 and we're all laughing. We're not laughing at each other, we're not laughing near each other, we're laughing with each other, and there's this huge energy that's just vibrating throughout the room, like happens in this room tonight. And I go running after my sponsor after that meeting. I'm going, what was that feeling, man? What was that? And he said, that's God. what? Get the, wait, that's God. Yeah, buddy, that's God. Well, and that's what I can get from the 12 steps and from the, yeah, we get that all the time. I want this God. I love this God. And that's the God that I've just discovered in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've discovered, like Johnny H., the founder of my home group, I heard him talk in my first 3 months of sobriety, and I had no idea he was paraphrasing his Papa Chuck C., and I heard him say that the 12 steps are designed to empty me of me so I could automatically fill up with God. And so my current experience is I'm an agnostic who, as a result of the 12 steps, as a result of having a home group, as a result of having a sponsor who knows who I am and what's going on with me, as a result of picking up the phone or answering calls from my sponsees, as a result of serving this program called Alcoholics Anonymous more than I serve me, I have this tremendous life. I have access to infinite power. And sometimes my ego will turn on and I think it's me. And then my life starts to turn dark. And then I start to realize, no, it's you. It's you. You're the ones that light me up. Thank you for lighting me up today.
Our second 10-minute speaker tonight is Jackie T.
Hi, everybody. My name is Jackie, and I'm an alcoholic. Wow. Very grateful to be here. It's truly an honor and a privilege. Thank you, Leslie, for asking me to speak. As soon as I found out, everything that went in my brain totally went out of my brain. So I went to one of my sober sisters, and she said, you're going to speak from the heart. So I just want to thank Clancy for the structure of the Pacific Group, because this was my first meeting that I ever went to. And my sober date is June 21st, 2002. My sponsor is Sharon. I'm a member of the Atlanta Group in New York. And I'm very grateful to be here tonight. And so there's no pressure for me because your main speaker tonight is Sharon. So here's my speaker, my sponsor, and me. So it's great to be of service. And last night I was in town to go see Depeche Mode. So last night Depeche Mode, tonight Pacific Group. So it doesn't get any better than this. I mean, this is where I need to be, because for me, I've been taught to put God and sobriety first. And I'm so emotional. Sorry. Because this was the first meeting that I came to in October of 99. I lived out here. I was in a relationship with someone, and I came into the other program, the Al-Anon program. And the women out in Studio City said for me to go to an open AA meeting. And I said, well, I was drinking. And they said, that's okay. We just want you to go to a meeting. So they brought me to this meeting, and I sat in the back. And I was so uncomfortable, I left at the break. But then they said, pick me up next week, the following week, to go. And then I went. And then the third time I went on my own. And that's when you guys used to line up on Sunset. And I was still drinking, and I had a bottle of something, and I hid it in the bushes out there because I was so nervous. But you guys still welcomed me. Now, just a little identification. Just want to let you know that I like to drink. Did anybody else like to drink? Okay. And eventually what happened is I crossed the invisible line. And like I told you, I grew up in New York. My father was born on 19th Street. My grandfather was born on West 21st Street. So I'm definitely a New Yorker. And I'm very proud of it. And for a while there, and later on when it came up in my character defects, so that I'm arrogant, I'm self-righteous, that's me. And recently I did the Ancestry.com. And it turns out that I have this Irish heritage, and my family comes from this town in Galway from the 1850s. It's the home of outlaws and rebels. So there you go. It's in my DNA. But when it came to the drinking, and I would be going out to the bars in New York, I like drinking. But when my girlfriends, we were Sex in the City, before Sex in the City, the four girls all going out to the clubs,
and I couldn't enjoy that first drink. I needed the next one and the next one. And when they would leave at midnight, I'd be like, wait, the bars are still open till 4 o'clock. Where are you guys going? And then it was the after hours places. And then at 7 in the morning when I'm stumbling home and I see the people going to work, I'm like, losers, losers, they got to go to work. And part of my industry that I worked in, we were allowed to have sick days in this union. And back in the day, we were allowed 60 sick days. So when I got to around 52, the boss would call me in and would say, you know, you're coming up on your number. I said, well, what is that? He goes, 60. How many do I have left? 8? Okay, good. I'll see you when I'm done with that. I mean, I was so full of myself. And especially when I first started coming around, I didn't want you to see my real self because I hid behind everything, whether it was sex, whether it was drugs, whether it was alcohol, men, anything, food, anything. I was so miserable inside. But something with the drinking, it just got me out of myself. So there were relationships and there were marriages and there's a whole history of things, and I'm up to about 4.5 minutes right now, but I'm just grateful that I eventually found out that I was an alcoholic, because you guys, you know, I was kicking and screaming. I didn't want to come in here. I didn't want to be an alcoholic. I was having too much fun. But then, like other people, anybody else crossed that invisible line and then it stops being fun? That's what happened to me. So as I said, I was out here in Los Angeles and I came to this meeting for a little while. I used to sit in the back and come around, but I was still so miserable. So the relationship ends. I want to die. Things are really happening, and I want my life to be over. I move back to New York. Stuff gets put in storage. I lose a job. I lose a relationship. I have no relationship with my family. And then I remembered I was, like Clancy talks about, that screw getting caught inside of me, and it keeps tightening and tightening. So I remembered about the Pacific Group, and I knew there was something called the Atlantic Group. So I showed up there, and then one of the women recognized me from that other 12-step meeting, and she said, you know, do you want some help? And I was like, yes. And I was very nervous, but I said, okay. And she started taking me through the steps. Because it doesn't matter, you know. And this is the part I always forget, that when I asked her, she didn't want to sponsor me in the beginning. Like, she was like, I don't want, after she started working with me, she didn't want to sponsor me. But her sponsor told her, you have to sponsor Jackie. And I really am very grateful for Ava saying that, because I had the willingness. I had the willingness because I knew there was something going on. And my relationship today with God and Alcoholics Anonymous is truly amazing. And I always tell my sponsees that I work a hard program so I can lead an easy life. And I mean, like I told you, I travel the world today. I have 2 jobs. One is very, very busy in the summer. So I'm constantly in motion. But I do still take time for prayer and meditation. I mean, it's awesome. If you ever get the chance, you know, meditate with your sponsor in the morning. You know, it's truly powerful. And or each other. Because I used to come in and want to have my police tape, and this is how you do it, and rush to things. The more I've had time and some sobriety, the softer I get. And I've had male sponsors, I've had female sponsors, but it wasn't until I came into with Sharon and Crane and my sober sisters, one of my sisters gave me her coin to hold. And another girl told me, speak from the heart, because this program does work. For a sick person like me that was so selfish and so self-righteous that would put everything in front of my life just to get that drink. To when my husband wanted children, we're divorced, of course, but he wanted kids. I didn't want to stop drinking. You know, and I did make amends to him. When I wanted to get married up on Martha's Vineyard and have champagne and Veuve Clicquot, it was always about everything else. My father was too sick. He was home dying with COPD. But because, you know, the ex-husband had the house up there and the family house, I didn't even care about my father and a sister. I mean, the selfishness and self-centered and what this book talks about in our big book and the steps, that was me. And I've since made amends to many, many people. And I just show up today You got me. This is who I am. I love our retreats. I love our conferences. I need to talk to Steve and sign up for the international. Because I have such a feeling for Pacific Group, because this is where I saw you guys getting sober. This was my first meeting. So now it's almost 15 years later to speak here. Wow, that's a miracle. And so I'm coming up on 16 years of sobriety. And I started drinking when my first drink, I hope we talked about some alcohol, drinking a little bit. I drank when I was 16, and and my first drink was a blackout, because I was doing the shots of Southern Comfort and chasing it with the beer. And then I had many, many years, another 26 years of drinking until I came in and around 44, and I surrendered. And now I'm going to have 16 years, because my last drink was July 4th of 01. But I have a true, honest program today. And then the other little part, too, is to help the women out here that I embrace who I am today. I'm a sober woman of Alcoholics Anonymous, and in less than 3 months, I'm going to turn 60 years old. I was born in 1958, so you know what? There's still a lot of living for me, and Nancy told me, Jackie, there's going to be somebody in here you can help. So at the break, I know if you need anything, please don't hesitate to ask. God bless.
Our main speaker tonight is Sharon C.
Hi, my name's Sharon. I'm an alcoholic. And thank you, Leslie, for the privilege of speaking to my family of understanding. I grew up here in Alcoholics Anonymous, I know so many of you intimately, and you know my story intimately, and we watch each other grow up here, and we celebrate, and we cry together, and we laugh together, and we're a community, and I'm very, very privileged to be part of this community called the Pacific Group and the Worldwide Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. They say when your teachers are in the room, you're more inspired, so we'll see. I don't know. Okay, we'll see what happens. Anyway, I was made in Iowa. Marianne and I were both made in Iowa. So thank you, Hero and Jackie, for your 10 minutes. I needed to get out of my head. I had a little more wardrobe malfunction coming here. And so got a little duct tape on my hem and, you know, works for a lot of things. And we were talking about duct tape in the bathroom. You know, that's what we girls talk about in the bathroom is duct tape. And I remember I was dancing in the French Quarter, and that was the time of platform shoes. So I was always falling, and, you know, I think I broke a bone in my foot is what had happened. So, I mean, not to be daunted by it or anything, we went to the bar and looking at my foot, and there was a little bone kind of sticking out the skin, made a little point. So we thought, okay, it looks like a broken bone. So the bartender had some duct tape. So we just duct taped the shoe right around the broken bone, and the next 2 days continued. We had a lot of fun. And so I can tell you if it's going to rain by my right foot, though. So that's just how I drank. Being from Iowa, it was my first resentment. And my mother said I was always just a loving little girl and very sensitive. And by the time I was about 6, I started looking for the mothership. I knew it had left me in Iowa, and I didn't understand why. I come from a normal family. They're all still normal. Then there's me. I thought see spirits and hear voices, and I had fantasies in my head, and my best friend asked me some secrets, and I told her. So she didn't play with me for 2 years. So I learned, do not tell your best friend or anybody what's in there, because it was centered in the mind long before I ever had a drink. And I was 12 years old, on a country road in Iowa, and I was hanging out with the Clark brothers, and they let me hang out with them. They had a 57 Chevy, which was fun, and all these cars pulled up on the, you know, out in the country on the, we had blacktop roads, and we all turned the radio station to a rock and roll radio, and we sat there, and I was looking around, and I went, my t-shirt's flat, I'm sitting next to 38D here on the foot of the Chevy, I don't have any shoes on. I have skinny little legs. And, oh, my God, there's the quarterback over there. And Canadian Club and Schlitz beer started rolling around. And my trainer bra woke up. I slid off the hood of that Chevy, and I arrived. I won the chug-a-lug contest. I could always outdrink everybody and drive you all home. That's what I did. And I just, from the beginning, there was a moment where I didn't care. I didn't care. I didn't care about anything because I felt the omnipotence of alcohol, the spiritual spirits of alcohol from the tip of my head to the tip of my toes just filled me with, I'm in charge and I don't care. And it was great. And, you know, I come from a family that they wanted you to succeed and become self-supporting through your own contributions. And they all managed to do that. And I was the one that, you know, I did get to go off to the White House when I was 16 as a young citizen of America. I won a contest, and I was your future. And that was truly a little scary. We got to go to the United Nations. They treated us really special. And I was drinking on that trip, and I found my little diary after many, many years cleaning out my room, and it said, I better be careful, because I was already 16 and knowing people were looking at me like, something's going on. And then it was college time, and it was the 60s. It wasn't say no. It was just say thanks. We had a lot of fun. And alcohol was the main thing. And I had a fake ID, and I could get it. And I was drinking and driving from the moment I got my license. College was a couple of years. And then I went off to New York City because I had a fight with my father. I got drunk with the priest. There was a lot going on. I had a suicide attempt. My fiancé cheated on me with his tutor, and I saw them one night. And so there was a lot going on, and I just started rebelling. I went on all the marches. I went on all the protests, and my dad saw me on TV on the local news channel disrupting a courtroom, and I think he said to my mother, is that our daughter? And he came down to talk to me, and that's when the priest and I got drunk on whiskey sours and ended up at a sit-in in the student union. So my dad said, you know what, I'm not paying for the party anymore, so I went off to New York City. And I started doing my Chapter 3, and New York City was great, but after about 9-10 months there, I started to have a lot of panic attacks, and so I asked my father if I could please go back to art school. And something had happened in that little time frame of leaving school and being defiant and fighting with my family and going off to New York, and I'll show them, and going back to art school, and I couldn't paint anymore. And something, maybe it was the Golden Rail up on Broadway or the West End Bar, and the bartender would have said, time to slide across the bar your talent. Time to slide across the bar any sort of God-given talents you have, musical ability, anything. Or King Alcohol, which one is it? King Alcohol, I'm taking that. And I went back to art school. I couldn't paint. I was depressed. And it was a very rough winter. I ended up coming to California for the first time with Bob Dylan. I know it's hard to imagine. I think it was Bob. I met him in Aspen, Colorado, so it could have been Bob. But in Laguna Beach, he went his way and I went mine. And then I ended up at a commune where they asked me to leave because I drank their bong wine and they didn't drink. I was beginning to stand out with people that were living on the edge, off the grid, and I'm the one that's the bad alcoholic. And I didn't care. I was like, you guys aren't any fun. You sit around drooling on yourself. Going, let's party, you know, and like even the dogs and the cats in that area were like, you know, just always high on pot. And it was like, oh, can't I, you know, like, I want to move. I want to go. Let's do something. And so they asked me to leave and they didn't leave. So they took me to a picnic and left me on Mount Baldy. And so, and bring your things, they said. I thought, that's odd. So, I ended up in Iowa again, and it was winter, and my mother said, you can stay here, but please don't get in your father's way. You know, don't drink in this house. Don't take any drugs. You break his heart. Well, come on, Mom. Really? Break my father's heart? But if he would go down the hallway, I would wait. If he sat at the breakfast table, I would wait. We couldn't ride in the same car together. At Grandma's house that year, they sat me with the children at the card tables. I had made the big table, but now I'm back at the card tables, And so somewhere in there, I had a slide across the bar of the love of my family. Somewhere, alcohol would always ask for pieces of my soul. And looking hindsight, yeah, who cares? You know, I'm footloose and fancy free. My mother used to say, you're footloose and fancy free. And I'd say, and one of my cries was, I'm not hurting anyone but me, leave me alone. Just stand back and watch me die, is what I'm saying, selfish and self-centered as we are. And I had the blinders on, and I wasn't going to fall in love again. I wasn't going to make anything of myself. I was going to just follow my heart, I thought. I'm just going to follow my soul and my spirit. And I ended up in northern Wisconsin at an organic farm in the middle of winter. Non-insulated schoolhouse, they heated with wood. We had to go buzzsaw the wood, chop the wood, split the wood to make tea. And I did a lot of that one-eyed because I'm drinking. And they didn't understand my alcoholism. I ran into an organic bunch of people. We bought 85 acres of land. My mother thought I was going to marry this guy. I painted mailboxes. That was how I got my booze. We named our farm Cow Path Farm. I remember that. And they looked at me like, why do you have to drink? Why don't you just smoke these things? You're just... Because I would tell them what I thought about them. I would, you know, I sat around, I tried to play the spoons. I tried to, you know, I tried to fit into their hootenannies. I tried to grind the wheat berries so we could make the bread and let it rise with the yeast and get it in the oven in time. And, oh, it was so much work. And I got very sick, and I went to a hospital, and I had a gallbladder not functioning. I had pancreatitis. And looking back, the doctor said to me, you shouldn't look like this at 21. Do you abuse drugs or alcohol? And I looked at him with all my sincerity and said, I'm organic. There was no alcoholism. There was no thought of something's wrong with me. It's your fault. It's always your fault. I can have a list of why it's your fault that I have to be this way. And I love being defiant. And alcohol fueled it until it wore me out. It wore me out and the defiance started to go. They went off and did primal therapy. I got drunk at the sheep, screamed at them, and harvested my crop, which was organic, seed by seed by seed of Maui Waui. And I forgot it at the deal I was making so I could get out of town because winter was coming again. And I forgot it, so I joined the carnival, which was in town that night. And, you know, now I'm in Arkansas calling my mother. And I said to Mom, hey, Mom, I'm with Matt Armstrong Shows. I'm a shooting gallery person. And she just went, what? You're what? You're where? You joined the carnival? She just burst into tears. I was like, oh. I said to my mother, I'm writing a book. Just sit back and watch me kill myself. I'm not hurting anyone but me. Mother, I'm writing a book. And I can't even imagine getting that call. And so she had to go up to this place in Wisconsin, and she had to get the cat that had been kicked by the horse. She had to make sure the horse was being fed. She had to get her antique furniture back that she'd given me, thinking I was going to make a life of this, that maybe this would have worked for me, this organic community. She had to go up there 4 or 5 times. That was a 5-hour trip, but I'm not hurting anyone but me, Mom. Leave me alone. I just left. And the carnival was, I didn't really get along with them either because I'm drinking tequila. And I, you know, the carnival, everybody has first names and they're all alias, but, you know, it's interesting when you, I have mace in one boot and my pint of probably port in the other boot. So I've always got something going. And if it's a night that I'm drinking and I'm not happy and I don't want to, I just bought all those teddy bears. I don't want to give them away. And those kids would come up and they pay me and, yeah, go ahead. And then they shoot their little guns and put those targets down. And if you get 3 down, you get a teddy bear. And they'd yell and scream. And I don't feel like giving them a teddy bear tonight. So I would take my finger and just pop it up. And they'd say, we shot down 3. And I'd go, no, you didn't. No, you didn't. We're going to go tell our dads. Go ahead, brats. And so they would go off and tell their dads, and their dads would come, and they would talk to me, and I would be arrogant. And so everybody would come over the joints, and the carnival would get in a big fight. And that happened 2 times. I'd mace somebody, and it would just, we'd get closed down is what would happen. And the owner didn't like that. So they ended up sending the police to my door one day. Well, Franklinton Parish finest down in the state of Louisiana, and I went to jail in Bogalusa because the carnival didn't want me. The carnies didn't want me. And so I went off to jail, and I had DTs in jail. They didn't come back and get me. And it was, I was in there about a week and a half. I had cut myself a piece of a Coke bottle because they were coming in to get me at night, and I was really paranoid, and I was having a lot of DTs. I didn't know that's what they were, but I was very paranoid, and they had pointed heads, and I could hardly talk to people. And they took me, and they cuffed me, and took me to a car, and they drove me somewhere and threw me in this room, and there's my father, my dad, my amazing father. And I don't remember much about that day other than, we didn't look at each other. My dad and I hadn't sat down and had a discussion now for maybe 2 or 3 years. We just looked at each other out of the corner of our eyes. I talked to him at 20 years of sobriety about that, and he said, all you said that day was, I'm not guilty, and it's not my fault. I'm not guilty, and it's not my fault. And they got me for sales and possession, and they were going to keep me. And my dad got ripped off, and he went back to Iowa and thought they were going to let me out, and they didn't. And finally, when they did, I found the French Quarter, and that's where my drinking got very dark and crazy. And that's where I had to slide across the bar my dignity. That's where I had to slide across the bar everything that I was raised to be and do. That's where I had to slide across the bar. There's no more God. I'd sit next to somebody on a bar stool, and they'd have like a seizure, and they'd flop on the floor, and everybody would just like, you know, there was no love. My friend Michael was shot and killed on Mardi Gras Day. I just thought, there's no God. I don't really care anymore. My mom and dad were going to Texas. They thought they'd stop by and see if their daughter was okay. And I answered the door that morning. I had my platinum blonde wig on, my dancing wig. I had a black eye that had been glittered up because the drag queen told me, this is, we make them look like shooting stars. So you could, like, walk around with shooting stars that cover the black eye. And I had my, you know, my platforms, my fishnet, and my zipper outfit on, and I answered the door at whatever time it was. And there's my dad and mom. And I'm living above on a tar paper roof apartment. And this is their little girl that could be anything she wanted to be when she grew up. This is the little girl that brought a lot of love. And I don't remember much about that day other than my boyfriend put the snake in my dad's face. He had a skunk named Crank that was running around. And my dad didn't come in. And I remember my mother crying into her baked potato. And I remember when they left that day, I went down to the bar, the Mousetrap Bar, and I had my Jose Cuervo nice and neat to the top, no lime, no salt, double rock glass, and back it up and back it up and back it up. And it didn't put out the fire. Everything inside of me knew it was over between me and my family. Everything inside of me wanted to just run after their car and say, stop. Stop. I want to go back and start over. I'm tired. But I knew it wouldn't change. I didn't know alcoholism. And 1975, I ended up in California, and I was on my way to Hawaii, and never got there. 20 years later, I got there. But I got to a bar called Barney's Beanery. Now, I was 175 pounds. I had spots on my face. I guess they're liver spots. I remember when water hurt. I didn't have a place to stay. I had a long red dashiki, a Panama hat, and my backpack with my book, Be Here Now, by Baba Ram Dass, because that was my motto, Be Here Now. And I was unemployable in the French Quarter at the local sad, sorry, stinky bars. They didn't even want me back there. My alcoholic friends from the French Quarter didn't want to drink with me anymore. And I'm on my way to Hawaii. For some reason, I met somebody going to Hawaii who left me at the bar at Barney's Beanery in Southern California, where I saw the big book on that bar, Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't really know and I didn't really care, but that girl, I guess, was going to her ANA meeting, and the bartender took away her keys so that she could not drive drunk to her ANA meeting. We took our drinks and went, good for you, Chris, go to ANA, as she slunk out the door into a taxi cab. And she was going to be my Eskimo to you. I had no idea. That was in April. In August of 75 is when I came to you. And from April to August, I don't really remember a lot. I know I was on a plane a few times. I know I got off at the wrong stops a few times. I know I did. I hitchhiked a lot. I didn't know where I was sleeping. Sometimes I would find a hallway. I worked for a half a night as a cocktail waitress. I didn't fit in their uniforms. And I couldn't remember where the drinks went. So he said, yeah, I'll pay for the night. Please don't come back. I had become unemployable. And I didn't even know how tragic my life was. You know, somewhere along the line, it's just around the next corner. And the grass was always greener, but I was pretty darn tired. you know, when I came to you, it was circumstantial. It wasn't because there was any virtue in my life, that's for sure. I had no idea that I was dying. I knew something was terribly wrong. I didn't call home anymore. My mother sent me a Valentine gift, because she always did, in a bar in Louisiana, in the French Quarter. She knew where I was working. And I wasn't working there anymore, but it made its way to me. So she knew I'd call home, because she hadn't heard from me maybe in months. My mother slept at night because of Alcoholics Anonymous. I thank you so much for that. And I also learned why the grass was greener. There was a guy named Normal who used to say it's because the other guy took care of his lawn. Ha, 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 ha. It's like, oh, is that how it works? Okay. But it was July of 75. I got on the back of a Harley, and I went to Palm Springs to party. And the bikers didn't want to party with me and left me somewhere. And when I came to, I was in some empty apartment, and I don't really remember much. And I had DTs. I had what I think were maybe minor seizures. I would wake up on the floor a lot of times, and I didn't know what would happen. And I had people choking me a lot. I had, like, a lot of violence. And who knew if it was true or not? But this night it was true. This night they were hurting me. This night they broke my jaw in three places. This night they gave me a concussion and broke my nose and drug me around on the cement and rolled me off the side of the road with chunks of my hair out. This night it really happened. And I remember at one point when all that was going on and I realized this was really going on and they were hurting me and I didn't fight for my life. On July 27, 1975, I quit fighting for my life. I stopped screaming. I remember making a conscious decision. And some gardener found me, and I ended up in the hospital in Palm Springs, and I was laying on a gurney, and there was a cop there, and I couldn't talk because it was hanging off my, it was just held together by the skin. It was, if I could have smiled, it would have, because it said my, I had to write my name because I couldn't talk, and I saw the word victim, and I went, oh yeah, that's me. I was shooting for victim, and if I could have smiled, I would have smiled. I would have said, call home, tell them I made victim, you know. It's like I've got this successful family. I've got my brother's a doctorate. My sister's a Mensa. She's brilliant. My nurse, little nurse Sally, is the sweetest person I've ever met. Moved to Alaska. And then they just had no idea that I was an alcoholic. And so I was in the hospital for 2 weeks. And interesting, nobody sent me an airline ticket. Nobody came to see me and bail me out. Now, my mother had gotten a phone call that something had happened to her daughter, and they didn't know what or where, but they heard California. So they found me 2 days later in that hospital, and they found out what had happened, and I was going to be okay. So my mother, for those 2 nights, I can't even imagine. But I'm not hurting anyone but me. Stand back and watch me die, Mom. I didn't know I was alcoholic. I just thought I wasn't meant for this world, and I didn't care anymore. And that's what King Alcohol had done for me, was make me fall in love with you. And then it made me not care about me at all. And I put myself in situations where it was almost lights out. They caught these guys. It was a big thing. I was a victim of violent crime. And a guy from Barney's Beanery came down and said, I know you have nowhere to go, and they're letting you out. You can come stay with me. And I lived above the liquor store on Palms and Overland called the Duck Pond. He would buy me cheap wine every day before I'd go to work, and I'd unscrew the top and stick a straw in it and stick it through the wires of the mouth where the tooth had been. And I would drink alcohol, and I was tired and done, and I didn't care anymore. There was nobody home in my eyes and in my heart. And on August 20th, he said, you have to leave, you're depressing me. I was like, oh, man. And on that day, I had no way out. As my sponsor said, I had no friendly direction, and I was bone tired, and I ended up calling my mother, collect with a, couldn't talk. First 3 months in AA, this is me, I talk like this, I couldn't talk. I was wired up. And my mother said, Sharon, I can't help you anymore, go to the Salvation Army. And when my mother was 94 years old at her 94th birthday, I always thought my mother, that was her idea. My mother was talking to somebody about the one time that her husband wouldn't let her help one of their children. So I kind of perked up because, you know, I'm trying to be present for my life. And I thought, I better talk to my mom about that day. So I did the next day. And she said, yeah, that was that day. Of course it was me. And she said, yeah, when you called, I wanted to help you. When you called, everything inside of me wanted to help you. But your father was there, and I put the phone on my chest, and I looked at him, and he said, we've tried. So she got back on the phone and said, go to the Salvation Army. My mother took the heat for that. She knew if she would have told me, your father said no, I would have been defiant again. Something inside of me would have pulled up and I would have said, I'll show them, and I'd be dead. $20, you'd have another speaker. Norm used to talk about seconds and inches. Johnny talked about it last week. We are the lucky ones that we are here. We are the ones that get to have the promise, a day at a time, that if we follow certain directions, we can have a spiritual awakening to find out that we found the mother lode. It's the mother lode of gold. We get to mine it the rest of our life and give every piece away. And we're at the point, at the 12th step, that we want to do that. That that's our awakening. That I realize my life is not about me anymore. And what a joy that is. Oh, it's so joyful to know that. But on that day, I ended up calling a girl, Chris. Her number was there. The girl in the bar with the big book. She said, I can't help you. Call Suzanne. I called a woman named Suzanne. And I ended up at the Pacific Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, where a man hooked me. He hooked me with his talk. I'm thinking I'm at a church. I don't know what's going on. These girls pick me up. I hate them. They talk about themselves incessantly. They're shiny and bright, and I'm in a bright car, and I can't even look at you. And my head is down, and my jaw is wired, and my face is beaten up, and I'm unwashed and unkempt, and I'm detoxing here in the rooms. Friendly House wouldn't even take me. They didn't even want me. It's like, oh, no, 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 no. When I walked in the room, somebody went, oh, no, 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 no. And so I turned around and walked out. So I detoxed here. And but the man at the podium said he always waited for the spaceship to land and say, you can come home now, Bill. I put my head up and looked around, and you guys were all looking like spaceship people to me. And I thought, I found my spaceship people. And that hooked me. I think we all have a hook in us, no matter what it is, to get someone's attention, to throw a little kindling on that ember of life that comes in here. Because a lot of times that's all we've got. I don't care where you drank or what you did. If you are tired enough to walk into Alcoholics Anonymous and sit down with a little bit of willingness, there's an ember in there. We will throw some kindling on it, and you will burn bright one day if you want to, because that's the chance we have here. We have a chance here to live a life of freedom. We have a chance here to live a life that makes a difference. We have a chance here to have a purpose. I always wanted to know my purpose, and on page 77 it says our real purpose. Wow, I saw that at 7 years of sobriety. Our real purpose is to fit ourselves. It takes a little work fitting myself. We got to work on that. To be of maximum service, not minimum. Answer the phone, show up, say yes, be involved. Maximum service to God, first of all, and the people about us. And Chuck C. used to talk about it rains on the just and the unjust. And I thought, what's he talking about? Yeah, okay. And then I realized, everybody gets a shot here. Everybody gets a shot out in the world. Love doesn't stop here when I walk out the door. My God is love. I got to take it out there. I got to just smile and have a sense of humor. Because that's the way I can live through the world. Because I need to come in here and sit with you because you're my solution. You're where it makes sense for me. Because I didn't understand the physical allergy until we started working the steps. I knew I was a mental defective. I didn't care. I knew it was a full flight from reality. Yeah, that's fun. Who cares? But I didn't understand the physical part, which I have. And sponsorship has helped me through all that. Being involved in everything that there was to do. I just said yes. I walked around here with no way to talk for 3 months. So you guys just would like pat me on the head and go, yeah, 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 you'll be okay. You know, you look tired, kid. Chuck Nesbitt said, you look tired, kid. Why don't you hang with us for 30 days? Take your pack off. And that was my surrender. I took my pack off. And then he walked away and came back and he said, no, you look really tired. And he invited me for longer. I don't know, maybe 60, 90 days. I thought, well, he was nice. He invited me for longer. But I couldn't talk for a while. I had a commitment washing cups at Echo Park because we had cups there. And we smoked and we had these ashtrays with all the ashes in them. And they would just knock the ashes out in the waste basket and then stick them in with a cup. So I'm supposed to wash. I can't talk. This is my commitment. I've got this guy, Michael, with a tattooed tear going, he's the dryer. You better get sponsored, you're going to get drunk. You better get sponsored, you're going to get drunk with his Texas accent. And then they're throwing these ashtrays in with these cups. And I have one big sink in that kitchen and I don't know what to do. Oh, my God, there's cups and ashes and ashtrays. And I'm just standing there like frozen. And Pat Lang walked behind me. She's old CIA agent or something. She walked behind me and said in my ear,
wash.
Okay, wash, wash. So that's what I did. And that's how I had to be, like, kind of guided through all of this. I slept on floors, and then I got the wires off, and then I got a waitress job, and then I got a $24 a week room in Inglewood, and then I got a car, and then they sent Hank Johnson over to me so that I could get insurance. They wouldn't let me drive without insurance. And Hank came over, and I made him a Mr. Coffee at my little hovel of a place, and we signed it, and he shook my hand and said, "Welcome to being a citizen," and that's what you guys did for me. You cheerleaded me through it, and life started, and sponsor, and going home at 1 year, and making amends to my mom and dad, and dad, it was really hard, but I did what I had to do. It was very short, and she said, "How'd it go?" And I said, "It went okay," and she said, "That's a start." Oh, start. Oh, my God, what do you mean? So I had to be a good daughter. I had to show up, and at 2 years of sobriety, my dad came out and walked me down the aisle, and I married a man in this group. And so at 5 years of sobriety, when I had better jobs and things were going well, I got a sponsor that said, "Call your dad up and pay him back the money you owe him." I thought, what? I owe my dad money? So I called him up, and he had read the big book, run a calculator tape, put it in the big book on page 79, where most alcoholics owe money, and he circled it in red. And said, "If Sharon calls and I'm not home, here it is. Give her the total." So I was a little resentful about that, and she said, "All right, you send the check, and you don't, you know, we made payment terms." She said, "Bill and Bob are watching. Don't be late." And then she said, "Are you willing to grow through this with your dad?" I was like, what a question is that? But good sponsors, you're backed in a corner, only way out. Yes, what do you want? She said, "Okay, put a note about your life with that check." And I complained about my wonderful family and how wonderful they are, and then there's the alcoholic in Southern California. And she said, "I don't care, do it anyway." My dad got a check and a note, or a check and a Hallmark card. This going home got easier. We were able to sit at a picnic table and have a root beer together after going to a hardware store all day together. Things were changing, and I didn't even know it. And he called me after Christmas, and he said, "I don't want your money anymore. Merry Christmas, but don't stop sending me your notes." And my dad and I got to have a lot of good times. And the beauty of that is I didn't get it until later when my husband, at 10 years of sobriety, decided to have the newcomer in the room. And that was painful. And I had this new baby, and I wasn't working. And, you know, Al wanted Jill, and it was painful. And Ginny got off the plane with 21 days smoking pot in Paris. And I ended up at Clancy's door on a Saturday with my little baby in a stroller sobbing. And he said, "I need a sponsor. I don't even." He said, "Okay, sit down, sit down. I heard about Ginny. I'm sorry. And we'll try," he said. "We'll try. Okay, we'll try." So I'm at the Saturday night meeting, and Clancy's my sponsor, and he happened to be there, and I'm walking towards him and her because they're going to get married or something, pregnant and married. I'm not really sure. I didn't really care. I was very mad at all of you. I sat there with my arms folded, my feet kicked out, and thought, walk over me. It's my seat, and I'm in pain. I was betrayed, and you guys all knew it. And Pat Lang, who's then Pat Hodges, I think, walked over me at the Saturday night meeting with a newcomer and looked at the newcomer and looked at me and said, "Look at Sharon. She's got 10 years. Do you want what she's got?" Ooh. But I was going to do one more little thing, and I was going to take the hot coffee back to Al and Jill, and I was going to baptize them. And Clancy happened to be there, took the coffee out of my hands, grabbed me by the shoulders, looked at me and said, "Sharon, you'll walk through this with dignity and grace." And I was going to say, "I want revenge. I don't care about dignity." But he said, louder than my head, "So you can be an example to others." I heard him. So I had to tell him myself. I had to quit shoplifting. I was hoping that they'd arrest me so I could call him. "I'm in jail from shoplifting because I'm in such pain. You guys all betrayed." And he just said, "I would have left you there." So I'm like 11 years sober, making amends to the Broadway for shoplifting. I mean, it was insane. But he was louder than my head, and I got through the steps again, and I started being of service again, and I left them alone, and my son would go visit his little half-brother, and he would get in the car and say, "This is what Jill did for me. Look what Jill bought. Look what Jill did." And my sponsor said, "You bite your tongue. You bite your tongue." And I bit my tongue almost off a couple times, but the beauty of that whole story is then when he moved on for somebody else, later in life, Jill told me, "I knew I could do it because I watched you. I don't get to judge who gets my example." She had watched me. And the beautiful part about that story is We do Mother's Day together. We're good friends. We've raised those boys. They were raised in the middle of all of you, and they are good boys. And Jill and I are close. And my son is getting married in France next month, and Jill is coming, and Daryl's coming, and there's a lot of family and people coming. And then afterwards, I'm traveling with three other women to parts of Europe, and Jill is one of them. And I had no idea when I didn't wish her drunk, but I wished other things for her when they were married. I had no idea that I was going to have a best friend like her. And my son got off the plane, I don't know, it was about a year and a half ago, and he had wanted to hear one of my talks. He wanted his fiance, I don't know why, but he wanted her to hear one of my talks. And he said to me on the phone, make it a good one. I was like, oh, my God. So I had to have poor Aspen listen to my talk over, which was, pick a good one, pick a good one. I don't know what's a good one. So she finally sent him a link, and he came back. And about 2 weeks into his coming back into the States, he said to me, we were having coffee, Mom, I didn't know you went through all that with Jill. Thank you, Clancy. He got to make up his own mind about his stepmother and his own mind about his relationship. And the beautiful part about, I want to tell you about getting amends to my parents, because when I went through that, I had no money. My car died. I called home every so I had their little grandson. And my dad called me 2 days later, and he said, he was being my dad, because the record then rubbed out. Those amends were for my father to say, we're driving you out a car. We're driving you out a car. We know you need a car. The record was rubbed out so my dad could be my dad and my mom could be my mom. Thank you, Alcoholics Anonymous. That was for them. And my father was killed in 99, and it was a very tough time for the family. And Clancy was out of the country, and I was with my man, Casey, 1 year, 1 month, and 14 days after that divorce, but who's counting, I met my man, Casey, in the rooms here. And he was my soulmate, and he was my love, and he was everything that I didn't ever think I could have. And so Johnny was there. Clancy was out of the country, and Johnny was there with Casey, and they got me and my son on the plane, and I got to Iowa, and the AA was already in the kitchen. Thank you. And at his wake, I wanted to play him an accordion number. Now, it's been years since I had played. And my dad is Czech, and he had a Czechoslovakian accordion over here, which was all buttons staring at me. And I thought, okay, I'll try. So I played all day long trying to play Amazing Grace, Amazing Grace, Amazing Grace. And I had this poor girl, Kathy, in the closet with me that I sponsor all day long, all day long. All day. How's it sound? Oh, it's better. You know, it's just So there it is, it's the wake, and everybody in town shows up, because it was very tragic. And they're looking at me like, who are you? It's like, they don't even know who I am. And I go to the rector, and I call Clancy, and I say, they don't know who I am, and I got to play this accordion. As you know, sponsors, you got, oh, my God, what's going on? Are they standing on a cliff? Did they break a foot? You know, it's like, ah. And he's going, Sharon, you'll do a beautiful job for your dad. I know you will. I'm so sorry this happened. But do me one favor. After you're done playing, I want you to look around that church, because there won't be a dry eye. But there'll be a couple of people sobbing. Look at those people, because they're the musicians. Snapped me right out of myself. I thought, what? And so we did a good job. But that's what we do. We make each other laugh. This is my dad's wake, and it's about me. And God bless, you know, my husband. Many of you knew and golfed with him and loved him, and we got to get married. My son walked me down the aisle in Las Vegas. It was one of the happiest days of my life, and life was good. And he got malignant melanoma, and they gave us 7 months. And we looked at each other that day in the oncologist's office, and we both said at the same time to each other, he said 7 years, right? 7 months. But we got 2 years and 2 months out of it. And can I thank the people, the men here who sat with him over there, who surrounded him and just talked Alcoholics Anonymous and your day to him. You weren't asking him, how are you feeling? What's going on? What are your numbers? You let him come in here and sit down and have a meeting. Thank you. And thank you, Cindy, for being at my house. And thank you, Sister Sheila and Sister Mary, for raising that boy with all of those beautiful ethics you did. Thank you. And thank you, St. Augustine's for that carnival because it had been on my list. How do I make amends to all these little kids I ripped teddy bears off of? And then my son got kicked out of kindergarten. He's doing great now. He's in his profession. He's doing wonderful. But St. Augustine's has a carnival that they raise money every year for all the things that they don't have in their, in their bank account for. And they said, anybody want to volunteer? And I volunteered for 8 years. I bought ride tickets. I fundraised. I did whatever they needed. And when he graduated from that school, I went, it felt like it was over. I felt clean and loved and wonderful. And I just want to tell you, grace is always here. Grace hits everybody if you want it. Grace is here. We just block it with those big black umbrellas. And we just put your hand out and let somebody pull you out from that block of God's grace. Because if you're here, you've already gotten it. Alcoholics Anonymous is my life. AA is first. If you meditate in my house, I have a dog and a cat, and they'll bring you presents while you're sitting there. A ball, a stuffed animal. That's my home, is that we share everything. And I will walk in tonight, and that dog will go, you're home, you're home, you're home. I'm so glad. I'll go down and get the mail, come back. He'll go, oh, my God, I missed you. You're home, you're home, you're home, you're home. And the cat will look at me like, yeah, she's home. But I just always remember what Mary Regan used to say, please, God, let me become half the person my dog thinks I am. Thank you, guys.
Celebrate AA birthdays at this meeting. For every 365 days of continuous sobriety, we give a cake with the appropriate number of candles on it. If you're a regular attender of this meeting and would like to take a cake with us, please see me at the door before the meeting. We have several birthdays tonight, so let's sing briskly and speak briefly. Birthday people, don't forget to pick up your candles from the cake table as you exit the podium. Tonight, our first birthday is for 2 years for Joseph T.
My name is Joe T. I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank Leslie for allowing me to take this cake tonight. I want to thank my higher power, who is God, and thank my sponsor, Rich Clancy, for the structure and the PG group. Thank you.
Happy birthday, Joseph. We have a 6-year birthday for Becca C.
Becca alcoholic. I want to thank my friend Lexi for giving me that cake, my sponsor Julie for the last 6 years, my higher power, AAPG, all of...
Happy birthday, Becca. We have a 6-year birthday for Robert M.
Hi, I'm Robert. I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to thank my sponsor, Dave Clancy, for the structure of this meeting, class of 2012, and all of you. Thank you.
Happy birthday, Robert. We have a 7-year birthday for Victor Van D.
I'm Victor, alcoholic. I'd like to thank my God, Jeremy, for being there from day one, my former sponsor, Carlos, who moved to Texas, all of you, PG players, class of 2011. Thank you.
Happy birthday, Victor. We have an 11-year birthday for Rick A.
Rick, alcoholic. I want to thank God, Sean C., for another great year of sponsorship, Money Count and crew, all of you. Thanks.
Happy birthday, Rick. We have a 28-year birthday for Roger A.
Roger, alcoholic. I'd like to thank God, Jerry, for 28 years of sponsorship. Alcoholics Anonymous, class of Yo-9-0, and the Bro-Row.
Happy birthday, Roger. We have a 30-year birthday for Michael C.
Michael, alcoholic. I'd like to thank the class of 88 and my good friend Al for giving me that cake.
Happy birthday, Michael. We have a 31-year birthday for Tim M.
Tim M, alcoholic. I'd like to thank God, my sponsor Phil, for his guidance. I'd like to also thank my brothers, Jim and Frankie, Sean, all the boys back in Belfast, John the camera, John the book, and the love of my life, Lisa.
Happy birthday, Tim. We have another 31-year birthday for Jeremy J.
Hello, my name's Jeremy Jober, and I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to thank Vic, Michael, Harry, Chuck, Clancy, and PG, and God for keeping me alive. Thanks.
Happy birthday, Jeremy. We have another 31-year birthday for Michael D.
Mike Denny, alcoholic. I'd like to thank a very loving God for Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to thank my sponsor, Dean, for leading the way for me. I want to thank Clancy for this incredible Pacific group. I want to thank my wife, Rosemary, for the love that she brings into our sober home. And thank you, Leslie, for letting me take this cake. And Sharon, thank you for a great talk tonight.
Happy birthday, Michael. We have a 32-year birthday for Corky G.
Hi, everybody. Corky Greg's an alcoholic. First off, I'd like to thank a giant of a God who is bigger than anything that life can throw at me. I'd like to thank my sponsor, Robert Cook, for all that he does for me. I'd like to thank Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd like to thank the Pacific Group. I'd like to thank the class of 1986. I'd like to thank all the people who were on the Sidewalk Diplomats crew this year. I'd like to thank the Pacific Group campers, the Pacific Group fishermen. I mean, that's a thing, really. And I'd also like to thank Clancy and all my other Facebook friends. Thank you.
Happy birthday, Corky. We have a 43-year birthday for Sharon B.
Sharon, alcoholic. I'd like to thank my God for this gift of sobriety. Clancy, my sponsor, for his example and direction. He's absolutely not ever steered me wrong. The girls that I sponsor, I love them dearly, my family, and all of you. Thank you.
Happy birthday, Sharon. And we have a 44-year birthday for a former secretary, Joe S.
Joe, alcoholic. I'd like to thank a loving God, a program of Alcoholics Anonymous, beautiful Barbara, the Snivellers for all they give me, and especially tonight, my sponsor Clancy for his, as Sharon was saying, 40 years of direction, leadership, example, and wicked sense of humor, which I love, and for giving me the Pacific Group. You know, I want to thank you all, each and every one of you, for your love and your support over the past 44 years. And I love the sober life that you've given me, and I want to keep going one day at a time. Thanks.
Happy birthday, Joe. That's all the birthdays. We had a total of 13 birthdays with 302 total years with a 23.2 average. We have a custom at the Pacific Group of donating $1 for each candle on our birthday cakes. At the end of the year, this candle money is our contribution to AA organizations worldwide. If you wish to participate in this custom, please see my assistants at the door when you sign up to take your cake. We don't say see.